Okay, it's a great pleasure to have the inaugural talk here. I enormously enjoyed the Future of Physics Conference, and I learned a lot of things. And one of the things I learned is that your talk should be longer than 5, maybe 10 minutes. And so what I'm going to do is not give a 45-minute talk, but I'm going to give a series of 5-minute talks. Some may run over a little bit, but not much. This is background information, and here is a picture of the brain. It looks like that. And what you look at when you see the brain is the cortex, and if you took the cortex off and unfolded it, it wouldn't be square, but it would be approximately like a square. That would be 1 foot by 1 foot by 0.1 inch. That's how big it would be. And the cortex across is very wrinkly in humans, even more wrinkly in whales, and very smooth in lower animals. And the reason is that the surface area of the cortex is proportional to the brain volume, not to the brain volume to the two-thirds power, as it would be if you just scaled up a geometric thing. So what this means is that for bigger and bigger brains, they have more and more cortex relative to how the volume of the rest of the brain, so it has to wrinkle up. The cortex, a single cortex has approximately 10 to the 10th neurons. Information is sent from one neuron to the next at points called synapses, and it has approximately 10 to the 14th synapses, and approximately 2 times 10 to the 5th miles of wire sending information back and forth all inside. And most of the wires are quite short, but a lot of them go over long distances. The brain, the cortex, is divided up into approximately 100 areas. And each area gets information from input from 10 areas and outputs information to about 10 areas, not necessarily the same ones. And so the whole thing is divided up in all of these different areas, so there are about 100 of them. Each one of the areas has a different function, and each one has distinct properties. And these areas were first discovered right around the time that Einstein was working on the theory of special relativity by Milman and Brodmann. And these are now studied in waking humans with functional MRI. So you can tell somebody, you can show them a picture, and then their primary visual cortex, which is B1, which is the back right here, will light up. The areas are very specific in what they do. So, for example, there are about 36
visual areas. Actually, 32, but I always rounded off to 36. And each one of those visual areas has different functions. So, for example, a lesion in V1 makes you just totally blind. There's another region over here called V5, or it's also called MT. And if you have a lesion there, then you can see things perfectly well, but you can't see movement. And there's a lesion, and a lesion down here in another area, D17 or something. I mean, no one really knows what the number is. I don't think it's...
Are they actually physically delineated on the physical boundaries?
They're physically delineated on the boundaries, and you can, and Bergman originally parceled up the cortex by anatomical ways, by looking at lots of brains. And down here, if you have a lesion, you can see everything perfectly well, but you can't recognize faces. So there's this hierarchy of areas that get more and more and more complex. From one individual to the next, there's always the same pattern of areas. That they're not the same size, so in this room, the primary visual cortex will vary by approximately twofold. However, the brain doesn't vary by twofold, and so that means that some areas are bigger in some people and smaller than other people. And so their exact position and their exact size varies, but their relationships never changes. So D1 is always next to D2, which is right next to it, which is always next to D3, and D1 never ends up in between. The reason for that is interesting, and that is that about 40% of the brain is long distance wires, interconnections between various areas. About 40% is white matter. And the white matter is axons that are sending information from between each area to 10 other areas and receiving it from 10 other areas, not necessarily the same areas. And the reason why you have the areas arranged the way they are is to minimize the volume of the white matter that's in there. Because if you just scramble them around, then you would be sending information longer than you have to. So you arrange them always in one way that's optimal for the white matter volume. Okay, this is background.
One question about
this.
Is there any theoretical understanding or ideas as to why the brain, you know, just developed a two-dimensional structure as a go down?
Yes, so the reason is that that it has a map on it. All the cortical areas have a map of some sort. That map is two-dimensional. And then there's a column
that are doing the computations for one part of
the map. And you could, I mean, logically, you could just take them and make them a big bunch. But you don't do that because, again, in order to minimize the volume that all the wires take up, you have to reorganize all the components so that the things that are closest together are the things that are most densely wired are closest together.
I don't care. I mean, if you have a three-dimensional array, would actually...
If it would be closer, right?
It would be closer, that's the wiring.
No, it wouldn't be closer because you have a certain number of wires and you have to distribute, you always have to put those wires every place. And if you started making it three-dimensional, then you would end up taking more space. This is a talk that Misha Trotsky would need to give you, because he's looked into exactly why things are wired the way they are, and can explain why you have things organized the way they are in order to get.
But it could be something else. I mean, I just said maybe it's, you said there's a map.
Yes.
And although we live in a three-dimensional world, we see a three-dimensional world. And maybe since the visual cortex is a big part of our brain, the initial complexity grew around this two-dimensional map.
Yeah. Well, all the cortical regions probably have maps. It's not just the cortex.
Yeah.
But probably they all have maps. But we're especially visual. So, for example, mice have a bunch of visual areas, but they're not nearly as visual animals, and so a big part of their brain is taken up with olfaction, for example, and also with certain kinds of somatic sensation. But all of these things have enough. Anyway, it's different to talk exactly why you organize things. So the cells have a special morphology. They have and they're arranged in a special way. And how you do it, how they're arranged, you can oftentimes explain by minimizing the volume of the wires that are connecting things together. Yeah.
You said that the size of E1 can vary by a factor of 2.
Yeah.
Is that correlated with just how well you see?
Yes.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Size matters.
Yeah, size matters. Right. So someone like Barry Bonds, presumably, people hitting a baseball coming at them at 100 miles an hour, but they have to make the decision very quickly, have to extrapolate where that ball is going to come and meet it. And people who do it so well, you're at the very limits of what humans can possibly do. And it's never been studied, but I would bet you that the good hitters have bigger visual systems than bad hitters. But it can't just be that, because it's not just what you see, but you also got to be able to have good coordination. But the good thing is, or the interesting thing is, that the coefficient of variation for the brain as a whole is not nearly as much as it is for the individual areas. And so even though Barry Bonds has, I'm sure, much bigger visual areas than I have, he has to have something else smaller.
It's not
his salary, that's the only Okay, so what do we know about the cortex? And not know. So here is the retina. And here is the primary visual cortex. This is V1, and this is retina. And if you show a letter A, project that on the retina, then there is the cortex then has a representation of that letter A that is not quite, is not the same, but it's sort of the same. So it's topologically the same in the sense that neighboring cells over here are looking at neighboring parts of the environment over here. But it's it's something more complicated. I'm going to tell you what it is in a second. And this is called a cortical representation of the image. And if you record from an individual's neuron here, which we have been doing for 40 years, then you can characterize exactly what this cortex does by knowing the impulse response of that neuron. It's called its receptive field. And so if you shine individual points of light over here, and then record from the neuron over there, you record that neuron's receptive field, and it's called phi, and it depends on x and y. And x and y are the coordinates over here where you put your delta function of light, and there are going to be a bunch of parameters that characterize each neuron, and I'm going to tell you what they are. Okay, the impulse response of an individual neuron in the cortex in V1 is proportional to minus x minus psi squared over 2 sigma squared x. I'm putting a subscript theta on here, and I'll tell you what that's for in a second. Minus y minus psi squared over 2 sigma y squared minus the subscript theta minus I omega x minus psi subscript theta. So this is a Gabor function. And this is experimentally determined to be correct. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a simple question, technical one. So when you say record, how do you do it practically?
There are different ways, but one way is you take a little tiny sharpened wire and you stick it near the cell, and when the cell gives a nerve impulse, currents flow in the volume conductor around it and cause voltage drops, and you record those. And so you can record, these days they have special ways they can record from a lot of cells at once, 10 or 20 cells at once. And you could, and the traditional way is everyone uses computers to get the data and everything out, but in the old days, you, and people still often do this, you take the output from the electrode that you're recording from a particular cell here, and you put it to an amplifier in the loudspeaker so you can hear it. And you show, and the way the original experiments were done is you would move a light around on a screen in front of the animal, and he would, and you did the right thing. In other words, when you've got the light in the right place for the animal's receptive field, you hear the cell was a brrrr like that. You would hear it giving spikes, bursts of spikes. And that's how the original receptive fields were made. And that's how the observations that led to determining this receptive field function were originally gone. So I'm going to explain a little bit more about what this is. Okay, so the parameters that describe...
Yeah? When you dream, do you also get a particular presentation?
When you dream, do you...
I mean, is there something happening that you can actually, can you trace back and tell
yes,
about dreaming?
Yeah, you are in study in a different situation, but when animals are dreaming, they replay in certain parts of their brain the experiences they went through that day. I mean, I presume they're dreaming. You can't actually ask them. These are rats. I expect so, but I don't actually know. I don't think anyone's ever studied
you
that.
You replay the first cut or the final?
Yeah. I think you probably replay lots of things over the whole brain, but the place that's really been actually studied is just in mice in a particular situation. So. Okay, so there's a bunch of parameters that characterize this. There's six of them.
So, but one of this polarization which is there, right? It's oscillation along x axis, right?
Yes, in the x direction.
What chooses x? I mean,
I'm going to show you. Uh-huh. I'm going to show you. Okay, here are the parameters: xi, eta, sigma x, sigma y, omega, and theta. So there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 parameters, and if you record from a cell and do the experiment, you'll find that each cell has a different set of these parameters. What do they mean? If you look down on this function on a contour map, it looks sort of like this. And this is the x direction here, and this is the y direction there. And the location of the center of this on the cortex is given by xi and eta. It's actually a different positions on the cortex. Each cell, it responds to light in a particular location and has a particular location in the cortex that it responds to.
So the second term is y minus eta?
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. And this distance here is, the scale of this distance is sigma y. The scale of this distance is sigma x. This here is 1 over omega. It's a spatial frequency. And there are two cells. There's one for the real, one for the imaginary component that compares. And And for every cell, there's a particular orientation that it likes. And so these things can come vertical like I drew it here, which would be theta equals zero, say, and then theta, and then you can have all possible orientations, and that's what theta is. And if you cut through this in one direction, if you keep, then, for example, phi of 0 and y as a function of y, looks like this, the Gaussian, and this would be eta there, and phi of x and 0, for example, which would be cutting through this direction, would look like this. And this would be phi there. Okay, so this is the receptive field of a neuron. I'm skipping over some stuff because I only get 5 minutes per topic, and so it's I have to hustle along with this. But this is basically the flavor for what you do. Now when you record from the cell, and I just short the letter A or look around the room or something, then it fires nerve impulses, and the firing rate, if I'm doing F, call it F hat, of the neuron that has parameter set P, in other words, it has all these particular values there, is equal to the inner product of phi sub P of X and Y and the image F of X and Y. So F of X and Y is the light intensity over the retina at positions X and Y. You take the inner product of that with the cell's receptive field, with all of the various cell's receptive fields, and that tells you what all the cells are doing in the cortex. Okay, so this is V1, and we understand a lot about this. However, we don't understand what I just told you about any of the other 36 areas, in spite of 40 years of trying. We know lots of specific things. We know, for example, that there are certain areas that are sensitive to motion, and there are other areas that are sensitive to optical flow, and V2, which is a very simple theory, we know a bunch of stuff about it, but we actually can't write down the receptive field function. We don't know what the receptive field is in any other area, in spite of all the trying. So what we can say is that we know one area, and we don't know the rest. Why not? It's hard. Why is it hard? And you can see why it's hard very quickly. Here is the retina with a circle on it. And when I draw lines like this, that means cells are firing nerve impulses there. And so all the cells where you put the light on are firing nerve impulses in the retina. Only a subset of the cells that correspond to those retinal positions are firing in the cortex. And the reason is that, see, these things are oriented. The way Huber and Wiesel originally found receptive fields is they found that if you just shine a spot of light on, you hardly get any response at all. However, if you show an edge to this cell like that, it'll fire spikes very vigorously. But the edge has to be oriented just right. So if you show an edge like this to this cell, these things here cancel out the excitatory parts, and you don't get any response. And so if you have an edge like this, this cell would fire. An edge moving like that, this cell wouldn't fire. So even though all the cells that have all orientations, they have a cell for all orientations looking at each point in the world, the only ones of those cells that fire nerve impulses when you have a visual stimulus are the ones that are oriented just right. Okay, so here's a circle on the retina. And here is the visual cortex. And the visual cortex has to have according to what I drew here, 6 dimensions. It actually has more dimensions than it has, like 10 dimensions, including time. But there are 6 dimensions that I showed you here. But I'm going to just draw that, and I will draw xi, eta, and theta. This is the position, the x and y position on the cortex, and the angle that the cell likes. And if you showed it a circle, then the cortex, the firing cells in the cortex would look like this. Because the cells that correspond to where light is here would fire nerve impulses, but only the ones that, that are oriented the right way, that are sensitive to this orientation here. And so you have, so basically this is kind of a tangent space, and the cells that are firing are telling you where this thing is in the tangent space of the cell. But there are actually more dimensions, right? There are three more dimensions. Okay, this is going from retina to V1. Then, when you go from V1 to, for example, V2, so here is V2, and I've only drawn three of V2's 10 dimensions. And what you do is you map V1 and also, this is V2 here, and also V3, the third visual area, sends information to V2. And so you have two high-dimensional spaces, and then you map those into a high-dimensional space that's lower than the sum of the dimensions here, and so you have a very complicated firing pattern of cells. The way Hubert Wiesel originally found this out, they just fiddled around and said, oh my God, look at this, it's firing at edges. Isn't that amazing? Because people never knew that before. But when you start going from V3 to V2, it doesn't just respond to edges. And the stimulus space that you have to explore to find out what the receptive fields are is so big that you just can't do it. Not only, and you say, okay, well, why not just short a lot of delta functions? That's what you want anyway. And you can't do that. And that is, as the cells are projecting from higher dimensional spaces over here, the rate of response to a single point of light is so small that it's a practical matter, you can't see it. In order to determine this thing, they used a special technique where they had to run the experiment for an hour or something like that to get enough data just to get this and go to a higher dimension, area, you couldn't do it. So basically, it's hopeless. It might be, yeah.
But do you even know that it's linear? Because you talk about delta functions as if you want to build up something.
It's kind of linear and not linear. Everything is linear in one, if you measure it one way, but if you actually measure the firing of spikes, the output of spikes, they often aren't linear. There are cells that are non-linear in here, and non-linearities are quite interesting. But you still can define a kind of impulse response for all the cells. And there are going to be some cells that behave, if you measure them partly the right way linearly, but not completely. So it's not going to be, the impulse response is not going to be a complete description of what it does.
Chuck, you said that the response to small points is extremely small when you go above V1.
Even in V1, it's very small.
Then how can we see, say, laser pointer?
How can we see a laser pointer?
How do you explain it?
The laser pointer would be averaging the response. If you show a laser pointer on the screen or a period in a sentence, then there are a lot of cells that are firing in respect to that, and no one of them fire very much, but you average over a million cells or something.
So then maybe we need to know the receptive field of a million cells, even for more complicated objects and not for a single cell.
Yeah, you probably do need to know. I mean, ultimately you need to know the receptive fields in some mathematically determined way. We don't know it yet. I'm just saying, why not just start by finding the impulse response? You just can't do the experiment. That's why that was my point. Okay, so what do we have to do?
Question.
Yeah, a second. Yes.
With respect to the question of non-linearity, isn't it possible that endpoint data somewhere along V3, V4, V5 is changing the way data gets mapped from V1 to V2 and V3?
It probably is. People think that it doesn't change it in an essential way, but they don't know exactly what the feedback from, say, V2 to V1 does. They really don't know what it does. Although, if you cool V2, the receptive fields in V1 don't change very much. If you stop V2 from firing, the receptive fields don't change very much in V1. So it probably has some, they don't know what the feedback connections do. Yeah. Okay. So, how are you going to do this? You have to have a theory. There's no way you're going to do it without a theory. And so what I'm going to do is give you an example of how you might make a theory that if you were clever enough, you might be able to figure out what B2 or some other area works, does. What do you want to explain in the theory? Well, the first thing is, your theory has to explain what V1 does. Because if you can't understand what V1 does, there's no way, if you can't have a theory that will tell you what V1 does, there's no way that theory is going to tell you what V2 does. It's got to work for you. It's got to work in general. And what would you want the theory to tell you? It would need to tell you something about the dimensionality of the cortical representation. Why does it have six dimensions? Why not five? Why not seven? And you would need to know the properties of the receptive field in some principled way, not just measure, but understand why it is what it is. And so I'm going to give you an example of the kind of theory you can make that might tell you these things. And the point was made by a couple of people in the symposium that there's a fundamental difference between the way theories work in physics and the way they work in biology. And in biology, you derive your theories from function. What does that mean? Okay. If you have a particle and it's moving around in the world, it's going to minimize its action. Its function is not to minimize its action. It's not going to die if it doesn't minimize its action. and you could say, oh, well, there are universes where it doesn't minimize its action, it does something else. But that's not really any explanation at all, because you can only live in universes where the action is minimized. But that's no explanation at all. That's just a restatement of the fact that we don't know why the action is minimized. But in biology, everything comes down to function. The brain is there to serve particular purposes, to give lectures, to find food, and so forth. And the visual system is there for giving you information about the world. And so what you have to do to make a theory is figure out what it is that the visual system is using, what function it's performing, and what properties it needs to have to perform that function. This is a challenge because it's hard to do. It's not obvious how you do it. In fact, what most people do is they don't do that. They just make a model of something, which is a perfectly good thing to do. But to ask kind of bigger questions like this is extremely hard. If you look around, okay, what is the visual system good for? If you look around the room, you see a bunch of objects. And obviously, to find food, to find mates, to avoid predators, you have to find them, you have to see them, identify them, and run away or pursue them or something. So it seems obvious to us because we see objects so easily. It's obvious, it seems obvious to us, it's not hard to do. It's extremely hard to take the complicated pattern of light and dark fed to the retina and extract objects from that. And in fact, in V1, you don't extract objects. And in V2, you don't extract objects. And in V3, you don't extract objects. And in V5, you don't extract objects. It's way downstream that the cells can be said to have extracted objects in the environment. What that means is that, so you have to go through a whole series of processes to get the objects out. A series of computations where you do things you need to do to get closer and closer and closer to having cells that will respond to objects. Which they will. If there are cells in the infratemporal cortex that respond to faces, one cell responds to one face and not to another face. Okay, so if you're going to have objects, if you're going to extract objects, what that means is that the early parts of the visual system, V1 and V2, they can't destroy the essential properties of objects that the later stages are going to need to identify the objects. And what is the main property of an object? One of the main properties for sure is its shape. Edges are also important, and that's I'm not going to talk about that today, but given that if you know where the edges of something are, if you have edge detectors, and these things actually work pretty well as edge detectors, then it's the shape of an object that matters. And it's the two-dimensional shape. Now, there's an interesting problem of how you construct a three-dimensional shape from the two-dimensional views of it. And I'm not dealing with that. I'm just saying, I live in the world, and I see a shape, and that shape is going to be an object. What are the properties of the object, of the shape of an object? If I can tilt my head, I can move closer to you and farther away, I can move my eyes around, and the image of your object undergoes, the image of an object, the shape of an object undergoes translations, rotations, and magnifications. And those are exactly the defining properties of an object. The shape of an object, of the shape of an object. The shape of an object is invariant under that group of operations, which is sometimes called the similitude group. The translations, rotations, and magnifications. And so the traction that you can get from making a theory is to say the abstract properties of objects have to be preserved. What does that mean? So I'm gonna start going over here. So I'm just going to do everything just to make it simpler in one dimension. And so we're going to have a one-dimensional retina, and this is x, and f of x is the light intensity across the retina. And then we feed this one-dimensional retina into a cortex, and the cortex carries out its operation on this, and it gives it gives f hat of t, which is the firing rate of the cells with parameters specified by parameters p, and maybe it looks like this. And so you have an image which gets translated into a representation of that image. Now, over here in the image plane, you can move your eyes around and you can get closer and farther. And so you can translate and and magnify this image and dilate it. And so you can have an operation which I'm going to call G sub S and T, which is scaling by size S and translating by T. Now usually what people do is they use a dilation. I'm doing the inverse of that. And G sub S and T, which operates on the function X, is equal to the square root of S times F of S times X minus T. That's the definition of this, and this is, and the only thing we're missing is rotation. I'm just not bothering with that. Okay, so you have an operation G here of S and T, and it takes you down to a translated and magnified or shrunken version of this, and you can go back and forth here with operations like this, and each one of those makes an image over here, a representation in the cortex, which is, and I'm putting a subscript S and T down here to indicate that this is the same as the one up here. This is the same as the one up here, except it's the result of having been translated and magnified by
math. What about special control?
What's that?
Conformal transfer?
Yeah, it's a conformal transfer.
No, I know that is, but there are others.
Yeah.
Like the translation of version.
Yeah.
And which is part of a bigger group. Conversion, surely.
So, but
images are, well, that's discrete, but if you combine.
Would that be
translation and version? That's a continuous group, which usually includes the relation.
Yeah.
Is that?
So I don't know if there, I don't think that there are any other groups that images are in, the shapes are invariant under. I think all the
inversion is in the origin, so x goes to minus x.
Yeah, that'd be reflection sort of, yeah.
No, it's not the same as reflection in the mirror.
Yeah.
Which is only x and
yeah.
Well, it's x, y, z, but minus x, y, z. And once you have that, then the three-parameter group, which is generated by inversion, translation, inversion again, it's a continuous group.
Yeah.
Which in physics, once you have scalar theory, this often goes along with it.
Yeah. This is something that I hadn't thought about. I have to go back and think about. I just haven't done it yet.
Once you have inversion, inversion is invariant, right? That's a discrete thing.
Yeah.
Not just mirroring.
Yeah. Anyway, I just don't know. I have to think. So what would it mean then to say you're preserving the properties of shape? What it would mean is that here you can make this equal that by just applying the inverse of that operation to it. That means that there has to be an operation over here where you have the cortical representation of an image and you have the cortical representation of a magnified translated version of it, and you have to have an operation over here that will turn this into that and make it the equivalent. That's what I'm claiming is the, I'm going to call that U sub S and T. Okay, I was going to give an example in the simplest case, and I'll just quickly say what it is. And the simplest case you can think of is where you have this here, and you have the representation over there, the cortical representation, and you define equality of two shapes, which is defined by the functions, just by saying it's translation invariant. If you do that, you can find out what the receptive field is. You can show what this receptive field is, and it turns out that what the cortex in that case would be doing would be doing a Fourier transform. And the reason that works is for the same reason that you conserve momentum in classical mechanics, quantum mechanics. Okay, so in this, so now I'm asking the question: what can you say about the receptive field phi of x, which has a parameter on it? What can you say about that if you require that you preserve the properties of shape by being able to take the cortical representation, which may look quite different from the original thing over here, and map it into that, make it equal by some operation that is isomorphic to the one over here? And the answer is, in this particular case, that the receptive field function has to be two parameters. It has to have two parameters, and those two let me go back a step. One way to do this, one way to preserve this is a representation of this group. One way, this is a unitary operator. One way to preserve that is just to have this operation over here be a linear transformation, transformation like a blurring or something like that. Okay, I'm excluding that. That actually does happen in the visual system. In the early stages of the visual system, you have a linear filtering of the image to go from that to its representation in a place called the lateral geniculum. I'm saying, okay, those are fine, but I'm asking, is there something more interesting than that? And there is something more interesting, which is that this is not the same operation as that, but it's a representation of the same group, but it's not the same operator. And in order for that to be true, then the receptive field has to depend on two variables, and it has to be generated by this same thing here from one function. So what I'm saying is, in order to preserve the properties of the image, of the shape, what you have to do is you have to generate all of the receptive fields, all of the impulse responses, from a single function by all the translations and all the scalings of those to get them. And you have to have two dimensions for doing that. If you do this same thing in two dimensions for the retina, then your receptive field needs to depend on four parameters. And it has to be generated by the group that's gotten by two translations of rotation and magnification. So omega is the scaling, theta is the rotation, xi and eta are the translations. So you apply this operator to one master function of x and y, one mother receptive field. And this will generate all the receptive fields. If this is true, then you preserve the image properties. Okay, so so what we've done then is we have said we need to know what function is. Function is identifying objects. An important part of the object is the shape. The defining abstract property of shape is invariance under the similitude operations, and if you're going to preserve that in the cortical representations of these things, so the abstract properties of shape are gotten are maintained, so you can still make use of them later. Then I'm claiming that you have to generate your receptive fields by the same kind of operation. Kind of makes sense. Okay, is it true?
Quick question on the group.
Yes.
Whether things like inversion or other conformal changes are narrow, it's basically an empirical question, isn't it? If you're going to,
yes.
Oh, you're trying to model actual vertebrae.
Yes.
Or if you're doing AI, you might want to do something.
That's right. But I still need to think about it. I mean,
no,
because it may be something that you have to say it's a possibility. Maybe somebody does it, or maybe some other cortical, some later thing does it. You know. Okay. Is it true? Yes. What does that mean? What that means is that this function here, which is empirically given, has to be all of these receptive fields that are only four dimensions here, they're not six. What that means is that sigma x, sigma y, and omega have to be related to each other. And there has to be one function of x and y that you generate all of these things from by this operator. And in fact, that's true. So if you make a graph of 1 over omega versus sigma x, you get a straight line with a slope of 1. And if you plot sigma y versus 1 over omega, you get a straight line with a slope of 1 over 1.67 with data like this. And I didn't do these experiments, and the person who didn't do them had something else in mind, and so he wasn't thinking about this, and so he never did these plots, and I did. I did it for him. And what that means is that psi of x and y is minus x squared over 2 minus y squared over 2 times 1.67 squared minus ix. So if you apply translation in two dimensions, rotation and magnification, the way I defined it before, to this, with all possible values of that, you'll get the Gabor functions that I started with. And some of you who know about this stuff will probably have recognized that what you're doing when you do this, when you calculate f of psi, eta, omega, and theta, you're taking the dot product of phi, psi, eta, omega, and theta of x and y with the intensity function that defines the image. And actually, because you're generating this from one function, what you're doing is a Wavelet transform. That's just the definition of what a Wavelet transform is. And the reason it's a Wavelet transform is because the De Boer function is an acceptable, it has the properties that you need phi to have in order to have it be a Wavelet transform. So the question is, what is it that Cortex does? What does it compute? And what V1 computes, maybe it doesn't want to, maybe it doesn't need to, but the way of describing what it does is to say it's computing a Wavelet transform, because the firing of each cell is the coefficient in the Wavelet transform expansion of the image. Okay, how do you, so, and that means that V2 is not three-dimensional, as I drew it here, but it's four-dimensional. How do you get four dimensions onto a two-dimensional sheet? And the way you do it is like this. You're looking down on the cortex, and there are a whole bunch of special places which are called pinwheel centers. And so these pinwheel centers are identified anatomically. There's a stain that you can stain and say, I can see them there. Around each pinwheel center, is at a different location in the cortex, and that location specifies xi and eta for the cell at that location. And the reason for that is that there's an orderly map called a retinotopic map of the world onto the cortex. So as you move on the retina, you move in a corresponding way along the cortex. And so these things are the middle. As you go around the pinwheel like this, you go around different orientations. So the cells here all have the same xi and eta, but the ones up here will respond to a vertical line, the ones along here will respond to a 45-degree line, the ones here will respond to this. As you go around like that, you go around all the thetas. And as you go along one arm of the pinwheel, the cells are all change. You have all different omegas along there, and as you go along from here to there, you go along a log omega axis. And so you really sort of have kind of little clumps, kind of little pixels of the world, which have the four dimensions that you need anatomically laid out there, and those are specifies the coefficients in the Wavelet transform. Okay, so what I've been doing is mostly reading the literature on other areas of cortex to see if you can use, the whole goal of this is to have a strategy to go beyond V1 to actually predict things. I didn't predict anything new here, I just got stuff out of the literature and showed this is a nice way of summarizing it. But what you want to do is you want to explain other cortical areas. And so I've been reading the literature, and there are things I haven't told you about that are quite interesting. And I'll just say what one of them is. All the way through, I never talked about the size of anything. I never said how big anything is. I sort of suppressed the rate at which cells are firing. But as you change these parameters, and if you're doing a Wavelet transform, actually they scale in a particular way with omega. They have to scale a particular way with omega. Turns out that you have all x's, all xi's, you have all different positions in the world represented on the cortex. You have all different thetas represented, but you don't, and you have all omegas represented, but not equally. So if you make a graph of the probability of seeing an omega as a function of log omega, it looks like this. So
the world is translationally and rotationally invariant, but not scalar.
But not, yes. And just like in a Fourier transform, if you multiply f hat of omega, which is a Fourier transform of something, by some function g of omega, that's like doing a convolution. This is also doing a filtering operation on the image. And it turns out that the filtering, and you can figure out what the filtering operation is, and it turns out that the filtering operation that you're doing by this way is doing an edge detection. So it's as if you took the world, you put it through a filter that got all the edges for you, and then you do your wavelet transform on that. Okay, that's one thing I'm looking at. The second thing I've been thinking about, which is quite interesting, is all the things I told you just have to do with one kind of cell. These are called simple cells. There's another kind of cell that seems that what it represents is that. In other words, it throws away a bunch of phase information. But there's some stuff I have to work out. I mean, this is a good description of what things do. It's a square, yeah. And where the square comes from is kind of interesting. I'm just trying to get some data from people so I can work on that. Anyway, so this is an example of a way that you might, and it's typical of lots of examples, that you might make a theory about something. But the thing that's so hard about it is that you always have to go back to the function. You have to think hard about what the function is, what's the damn thing trying to do. And you might get it wrong. A lot of times you do get it wrong. But if you don't get it wrong, you can sometimes make progress. And this might be a recipe that we can then carry on to other quartic letters. Okay, thank you.
Question?
Thanks.
I'm returning back to this kind of two-dimensional surface. It looks like what you're saying, my understanding is that essentially this region is two-dimensional stuff, right, by itself.
Yes.
So in this sense, you do have two-dimensional map anyway, you know, whatever, yes. You know, fold it or whatever you will do it. But then when you are saying about this X dependence, for example, it looks like, okay, so for example, to make a three-dimensional, you have some bunch of two-dimensional images, right? But when you are talking about this X dimension, it looks like you are doing kind of one-dimensional projection, right? No, you have two-dimensional stuff, but I mean, in some sense, when you can present this two dimension as stacks of one dimensional stuff, it's a wrong interpretation, what I'm saying. Yeah, because when you are talking about this transformation, for example, it's also a feature of this kind of two dimensional stuff, because once you have a plane, you can say that you have conformal transformations,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's characteristic of play.
Yeah.
There's another invariance in the world, which is translations in the third dimension.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Which is not just scale invariance.
Yes.
Two dimensions.
So that's something I haven't thought about, but what you do is you take the two-dimensional world and you reconstruct three-dimensional images of it. Because you all look quite three-dimensional to me. And so I'm having to do that. Now, it turns out that is what the engineers call an ill-posed, or some of the mathematicians call an ill-posed problem. Because when you do projections of a three-dimensional world onto a two-dimensional surface, you throw away information, and there's not enough information in two-dimensional images to recreate a three-dimensional space.
Not enough.
And so you have to wire in some constraints about the way the world is. to do that. And so the what we do is we actually keep information separately about the two dimensions, and that is that there are cells in the cortex that are mainly driven by one eye, and then there are cells that are mainly driven by the other eye, and they're interleaved like that. Uh-huh. And then they get combined into a map that has to do with, it's not very well studied, but has to do with differences between them. And so there is a sort of Z dimension that's kept in there somehow, and I haven't thought about
it. But it's like holographic dimension, right? Because you mean that there is a phase relation between those, right? Because how you have to, that's, you can say that you have two-dimensional images, yeah. but it's not just images, but because you also have kind of knowledge of the phase between.
Between, sure. Yeah, because the eyes are separated.
Right. Yeah. But so so when in holographic image you do have, you know, this information about right. the phase, right?
Yeah.
But the step could be still two-dimensional. I mean, yeah. itself.
Yeah. What they think, what people think about this, I don't know a lot about this, but what people think about is that the way you get two dimensions is you take these two-dimensional images and you make use of properties like there's a lot of symmetry in the world. So you cut down your computations by making use of the fact that most things are bilaterally symmetric that you're looking at, and you somehow store in memory a bunch of representative pictures. And then you sort of interpolate between them and then look that up somehow. Exactly how you do that.
But it's got to make so much more than that because I close one eye.
And it's still, that's right. Yeah, that's right. But that's partly proves it has to be that way. Because if you close one eye and things are still three-dimensional, there's no three-dimensional information there. All you get is two-dimensional. So it's got to be that you're kind of projecting onto from other cues that are. If you move your head, that helps a lot, and that's true. If you have, if you can't tell where a sound is from, a lot of times what you do is you start killing your head like this, so that you can change the phase and the intensity of the sound at different places. The same thing for you can't tell three dimensions. You sometimes start moving your head unconsciously to see, so you can have relative motion, things like that. Those are a lot of keys.
You use a computational information processing vocabulary, just inevitably to talk about this. Have the efforts in machine vision been of any use in terms of ideas about how to approach some of these problems, or are they going about it in such different ways that it's not relevant for the biologist?
Machine vision is something that I know very little about. You'd think I know a lot about it, right? But I know very little about it. And I do know people who work in machine vision, and I know some things that they do, but some of them know a lot about real vision. But I would say that it's like a lot of parallel areas, it really hasn't impacted very much. And probably it's because they aren't, there are some things that I think machine vision community has looked at that are of interest to the visual people, but not really so much. But there's probably stuff that I just don't know about. Yes.
In your ideas of function driving theory, it seems like part of it should also be efficiency. I know people working in turbulence found results that if you take a turbulent field, you throw away 99% of the information in a Fourier. Space, you completely lose track of what the thing is doing if you do it after a wavelength transform, you can actually see your coherent structure still pretty close to what you normally do. So it's very efficient for keeping that coherent object. Yeah. And it seems like something
Yeah. So what you're saying, I think if I'm understanding that, what you're saying is, you know, why in the world is the Gabor function? Why not something else? I mean, you're picking your wavelet, and that wavelet is obviously picked for some reason. And the Gabor function is interesting because there's a kind of uncertainty principle. If you want to represent things, this wavelet transform represents things both in space and in the omega, in the frequency domain. And the function that maximizes the resolution in both simultaneously is a Gabor function. And so probably there's something about the Gabor function that I haven't thought much about yet that would let you pick this so that you do have a very sparse representation and you can throw a lot of stuff away and not have to worry about it. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.